Okay, thank you, Olive Cavera. Thank you as well to people who asked me to do this or encouraged me to do this to talk about my trip. I just wanted to show you this picture to start with. This is that's my tent there. Not a very sheltered spot. This is in Scotland. So I wanted to show this just because, well, as Olive Cavera said, I've done a lot of wild camping, and so that, I think that made it easier for me to do what I want to talk about now. So I've got a fairly long-standing love of the Pyrenees. I first went to the Pyrenees on the way to my ordination course. I was getting ordained in Gukiloka, 2001. And Gukiloka's in Spain, and I wanted to make a bit of a mythic journey to get there. So I took a sleeper train to Aix-les-Thermes, which is in the French foothills, and I walked for 9 or 10 days over the Pyrenees and got to a village in the Spanish foothills. And I really fell in love with the Pyrenees in that time. This is not that area, this is very close to where I was. This is just a few pictures of, what I see about the Pyrenees. I was there in the winter a few years ago, camping, which was chilly. So it has those high mountains, but it also has things like this. This is a beech and box forest. And when you get to places like this in the Pyrenees, it's just like Wales. It's incredibly wet. You've got moss dripping on the branches of the trees. And you've got, carpets of moss a foot thick on the ground. And damp. That's a beech forest. So, nice camp spot. Can't really see it underneath the logo. So these are mostly from previous trips to the Pyrenees. So last year, as Alakura said, I went to the Pyrenees, and I was going to go for 3 weeks, and my then girlfriend, who was then Lindsay, who is now Singhamati, asked if she could come with me, and I said yes. So we spent the first week in her Singhamati meditating in a beech forest in the evening sun. So we spent the first week in the Pyrenees, and then we found a dead cow, which was covered in vultures, which is very dramatic. They're like pterodactyls. They're like prehistoric animals. They're huge. Their wingspan is about the length of the cow. And the other thing I got into there was photographing wildflowers, which is very difficult, but I got quite obsessed by trying to photograph wildflowers. That one isn't upside down. That's a photograph of a spider, which is the right way up. That's an orchid. Irises. That was a field of irises. There must have been hundreds of irises, and I slept. I didn't put my tent up, I just slept on this grassy hillside amongst hundreds of irises. So this is the Pyrenees last year. Singhamati had left, and I'm basically going higher. I'm getting higher up into the mountains. I was there for 3 weeks last year, 2009, and probably for half of that, maybe more, I was looking down on clouds. So above the clouds, looking down on France and Spain, which seemed to be mostly under cloud. Delightful place, delightful. It's got excellent weather, and it's got the sort of rocky dramaticness that you'd always hope for in mountains, but it's also got that lush greenness and wetness. So it's, there's never a problem with water. So this was a campsite. This was a delightful evening last year. such a nice evening, I didn't bother putting my tent up, I just slept. That's my stuff, lying by the, just on the grass. I just slept in that grassy spot and watched the sun slowly sink into the sea of cloud. So that, and then the next day was this spot, which this was my first sighting of chamois. These are chamois on the snow, and they're also chamois on the mountain peak, which is a classic photo because that's where you see chamois. They're always either on snow or on the tops. You very rarely see them grazing or eating anything. That's what they love. They love the high mountains. They're like, I'm not sure if they're a goat or a deer. I think they're a type of very shy mountain goat. They live in herds, just in the high mountains. And so this was that next day. And the next day, I was walking from there, I was trying to go south, and I found myself on this steep, rocky slope. And I found myself going down I was alone, I had a heavy rucksack, it was wet, and there was no path. I wasn't quite sure where I was, which is unusual, but I wouldn't quite know where I was. And I was trying to get down this very steep, loose gully on the mountain. And it was getting more dangerous as I was going down. And this was the mountain I was trying to get down. I was trying to get down somewhere here. And I remembered Sangharakshita's last words to me as I left for the Pyrenees, which were, Saraha, don't take any unnecessary risks. So I thought, well, this is an unnecessary risk. I don't need to go down this way. I can go up here and along. Something you never want to do. If you're trying to go down, the idea of going up and along and down is always something I resist immensely. I'd much rather take crazy risks. But I remembered Sangharakshita's advice, and so I went up and started going down a safer way. And then I got to a place that was like this. I could see that tree, and I thought, if I get to that tree, I'll be able to get down safely down there. So as I was getting to the tree, I was getting closer to it, and I stopped to just take my rucksack off and sit down. And I looked around, and there was a cave above me. And so I left my rucksack where I was, and I walked up to the cave. And on the way, I saw that rose. And I think it was the first rose I'd seen in the Pyrenees, and it was just a perfect rose. It just had a few leaves, and just that perfect single flower. So I kept going up, and I got to the cave, and this was inside the cave. This was sitting inside the cave. And it was, as soon as I got there, I was quite struck by it. It's quite rare to find a cave in the mountains that is anywhere near habitable. And this one was near habitable. It was very jagged. It's a very rough cave. It's basically a 45 degree crack in the rock, 2-3 meters apart. And in the upside of that, there's some massive boulders the size of cars jammed in the rock, which makes you can get in behind the boulders effectively, and you're relatively sheltered in there. The floor of the cave is a 45 degree boulder field, but right at the back, where it's very dark, there's a little flat bit, a bit smaller than a single bed. And that was very flat, it was perfect. It's flat and smooth and soft. It was lined with probably several inches of chamois dung. So it seemed quite well insulated and comfortable to me. So I stayed there that time for 3 nights. Oh, one other thing about that cave. As I say, it's a jagged cave. The walls are jagged, the roof's jagged, the floor's jagged. and it's all sort of like this and broken and cracked. But just there's two of the big boulders, you can get out between two of the big boulders. So it's got like a side door. You've got the main door, which is that you can see we're looking out of there, we're looking down about 45 degrees. But there's a side door that you can get out of. And just as you're exiting through this side door, on the right, there's another little cave, which is about 18 inches wide, 18 inches high, and 2 feet deep. And it's got a perfectly flat bottom. And it's got a roof that's just delightful like this. It's a very simple cave. It's almost like an archetypal cave. And it's as soon as I saw it, I thought, that's where my Padmasambhavarupa lives. It's exactly the right size for my Padmasambhavarupa. So I was tempted to take that this time, but what with one thing and another, I didn't. So after the cave, I stayed there for 3 nights, meditated a lot, which was, it was very interesting. It was very interesting meditating in a cave. It was the first time I'd done it in that way. I think it was on the second night, I was meditating and I thought it was cold. Middle of July, in the south of France, I opened my eyes and there's a blizzard going on outside. And this is a photograph of the next morning. So the next morning there was snow and ice. There was 2 inches of fresh snow all over the mountains up where I was, and going down a few hundred metres as well. And so I got very trigger-happy with the old camera. That's a self-portrait, wearing every single piece of clothing that I'd taken with me, including 3 hats, I think. So that's the view out of the cave doorway. That's the view out of the side door. When I left the cave that time, I left in it a copy of the Dhammapada. I left the first 3 chapters. I cut the sacrilege, I know, but I cut the first 3 chapters off my Dhammapada and wrapped them in plastic and left them in the cave. I wanted to make sure that I'd go back. I wanted to leave something of me, and I wanted to leave something of the Dharma there to make sure I'd go back. So I did that, and I left. And this is looking back. The cave is, you can see it there, that black dot on that steep slope. So I left the cave, and I set off to the Vignimal, which is a very famous mountain. That is the Vignimal. It's a very, very impressive mountain. This at the bottom is a glacier. And that is a close-up of the glacier. And that is a marmot. It's a classic photo, that, with a marmot in the glacier. I could see it from 100 years away, and I was thinking, that's going to move before I get it in front of the glacier, but it didn't. It just sat there. Very impressive mountain. Limestone, big limestone lump, with glaciers on at least 2 sides. So I spent this was last year again, I spent the next 2 weeks or week and a half walking, and this is a view out of my tent doorway, as is that. So I got to the Cirque de Garveny and went home, and when I got home, I knew I wanted to go back. Yeah, I knew I wanted to go back to this cave. I've done quite a few solitaries in the past few years. And, well, my previous solitaries they'd sort of developed themes during the solitaries. There was one that I was, well, the theme that emerged was mindfulness. And I did a lot of mindfulness practice, walking meditation, mindfulness breathing. And the next one, which was, I think, last year, the theme that emerged was metta and karuna. But this time, I was planning to go to this cave, and I had an idea that I wanted my theme to be contentment. I wanted to focus on contentment and tranquility. If you read the Pali Canon, if you read any book on Buddhism, it goes on so much about peace and contentment and the calm of practice, the calm of attainment. So I wanted to spend some time just trying to feel my way towards that state of peace. Always when I'm on solitaries, I do lots of just sitting, and I do lots of just sitting doing nothing. So I'd spend hours doing nothing. But I find being in a building quite... It's too sterile somehow. I can't do nothing for more than 2 or 3 days in a building. I start climbing the walls just because it's so stable, nothing changes. When I'm in the mountains, normally when I'm camping in the mountains, I don't meditate very much. I'm just content just to be in the mountains. But I wanted to be in a space where I was in the mountains, preferably the high, snowy mountains where the weather is dramatic. And I wanted to be able to meditate. I wanted to be able to do lots and lots of just sitting, and lots and lots of just sitting around doing nothing. Because in the mountains, there's enough stimulation coming in that is simple. It's very, very simple. But it's enough just to keep me engaged. You know? So it's very simple. It's very beautiful. And it comes with certain challenges. Being in the mountains at that altitude, it does come with certain challenges. I also, one of my main practices over many years has been reflecting on the 5 skandhas. And the 5 skandhas are a description of us, a description of you, a description of the human being. They're a very dynamic description. They're not telling you what you are. They're telling you how you operate. That's what the 5 skandhas are. They're telling you what is the process. What are the processes that go on in the psychophysical organism? And I wanted to go deeper into that, and I wanted to see if I could let go of samya. So the 5 skandhas, you've got rupa, you've got form, then you've got vedana, you've got feeling. We all know what vedana is. You've got pleasant, painful and neutral feeling. After feeling, you've got samya, which is interpretation, yeah? Or it's discrimination, it's labelling. It's the immediate precursor to papancha, which is mental proliferation. Papancha doesn't necessarily follow from samya, but it usually does. And if there is prapancha, well, there has definitely been samnya. So I wanted to... And after samnya, you get samskara, which is volition. And then there's vijnana, consciousness. So I've been reflecting on these for years, and I wanted to get to a space where I could somehow let go of or soften samnya. I wanted to try and get to a space where I wasn't labelling everything that I saw, yeah, where my mind was quite quiet. I wanted to get to a space where I could sit in meditation and not be trying to work out what was going on. Yeah. I felt that I've got enough trust in the practices that I do, that I've inherited from Bantu and our tradition, that I can just do them without continuously watching to see what effect they're having or what state I've got to or not got to. I wanted just to sit and do the practices and not analyse, not question, just do them. And I wanted to... I often on solitaries don't study very much, if at all. And I very strongly felt, this was, you know, last year, in the last 6 months before I went to the cave, I've done enough study in my life. I've done enough reading and study of Buddhist texts to be able to just stop for a while and just let what I've already learned do its thing. Yeah. So that felt like quite an important urge. That was what I wanted to do. That was what my desire was. So I was thinking about how to get to this cave and how to get enough food up there. I need to take a lot of food. And then one day, I think I was talking to James, and I said, my memory is that I said, sorry, James, because we've been talking about going wild camping for years. And I said, sorry, it's not going to happen again this year because I want to go to the cave, unless you come with me. And then from there, it sort of evolved, and I put an advert in Shabda asking if people wanted to come with me and help carry food. And in the end, there was four of us, James, Kev, and Artabandu, and me. And it was interesting. I talked to Bansi about this, I talked to Sangharakshita, and he was delighted that he loves it when people do things together. He loves it when people help each other and have got a common project. And he started referring to them as my bearers. I've been calling them my Sherpas, or my slaves, but he just called them my bearers, which I thought was a much more delightful way of referring to them. So it wouldn't have been possible to do what I did without these three guys. So that was, that was wonderful. I was aware that some of them, most of them, hadn't really done anything like this before. And when I was looking at the weather forecast, me and Mahasiddhi were looking at the weather forecast, and the snow line was about 1,000 meters lower than one would have expected at that time of year, and the weather was pretty bad there. And I was a bit anxious, partly for myself, but partly for these guys. I made some alternative plans in case the weather was really bad. I had some extra maps and had some other places we could go to in the Pyrenees that were not as high. So we met on the international retreat. This is, where was it, Whitchurch Station? This is Whitchurch train station. And I had 50 kilograms of food, which we loaded into our rucksacks. That's my rucksack there. That's the sleeping bag on the outside, the tent's on the outside on the other side, carry mats on the outside at the back. So the bottom 8 inches is clothes, and the rest is lentils, rice, chocolate, nuts, dried fruit. And the other guys had similar ridiculously heavy rucksacks. They were ridiculously heavy rucksacks. So we set off, I think we took 11 or 12 forms of public transport, and eventually we got up into the mountains. And this is where we arrived. This is us finally trekking up into the mountains. That's James resting some weary knees. So this is very close to where we ended up camping, and there's where we camped. We camped there for, was it two nights or three nights? Two or three nights we camped there, and I collected all the food that I was going to keep, and we buried it. I buried it under a pile of rocks to keep it away from the marmots, which was mostly successful. Not entirely, but it was mostly successful. So that's Kev looking completely the part and tranquil, sitting by his tent. Can you see that? That's a very dramatic high mountain in the background. Lots of snow. That's our campsite. Lots of snow around. We could dig a hole in the snow, so we had a fridge to keep our chocolate from melting. It was very, very hot. We had very lucky weather when we got there. It was pure blue sky. It was very, very hot. And I thought we had a really delightful time. It's very simple. We, that's me swimming. So we spent a few days camping up here, and we got into a very simple routine of meditating together. We'd find a sheltered spot, sheltered from the sun, to sit in meditation together. And every day we discussed the Dhamma. We sat around, and I think it was mostly verses from the Dhammapada. And it was just a very simple time. There wasn't I felt like when I'm camping on my own, there wasn't a need to do much. We could very, it was just in those sort of environments, there's no distraction other than the beauty of nature. So you don't have to do much. You know, the conditions are pretty much set up for positive mental states, for even for, you know, for quite lofty mental states, without you noticing it. And then I buried all the food and we left that spot. There's some very light rucksacks setting off down the valley, and we walked down this valley. It was still a bit tricky in places. Lighting fires to cook on. That was a highlight, wasn't it? Bangers and mash. That place as well, when we were there, in the early morning, there was this wonderful mist rolling up the valley and then rolling back again. I remember I was lying in my tent, I just woke up, and I was lying in my tent, and I unzipped it, and I could see James standing there watching this mist in a very typical James fashion, just standing there for minutes, for hours on end, maybe for half an hour, just watching this mist rolling in, and it would engulf us. Suddenly we'd be inside a cloud, and then the mist would recede and it would roll back, and this is it, just receding or just coming up. So down we went. That night as well, the morning here, there was an amazing thunderstorm. It wasn't so much thunder, it was lightning. It was like strobe lightning. Every 1 or 2 seconds there was a lightning flash, and it chucked it down. There was a high limestone plateau that we crossed, and then down we went to another of these wonderful forests, these wet beech and pine and box forests, and that's a salamander, which is a very damp little animal that lives in these forests. That's a river that was very entertaining to cross, from what I remember. And we got down near to a village where these guys were going to leave me. We had our last camp together. And then they left, and I walked back on my own. And I'm going to read little bits from my diary. I was wondering when I was preparing to do this what to talk about. And the first question that came to me was, what am I going to not talk about? And what am I going to leave out? Because it was quite a strong time. I've been realizing that more just the last couple of days, preparing for talking about it. And I thought I'll just read bits from my diary, and I'll just not leave much out, really. So it might be, well, I don't know what it'll be. I really don't know what it'll be. So on the way back up, it did feel a bit like a death. It felt like I was leaving civilization. It felt like I was leaving for a whole summer. It was a whole summer. I was missing a whole summer. I was up in the mountains on my own. And it was like, why am I doing that? And the weather was awful. It was chucking it down. And if it wasn't chucking it down, it was just drizzling and wet. And when I got back to that river, it was like, I am not crossing that river. And I lay in my tent for 2 days, hoping this river would go down so I could cross it. And I was just lying in my tent, sodden. And I started to get a bad back. If I spend a lot of time lying around in damp tents, I get a bad back. And then one night, I think it was there, waiting to cross this river, I had a dream. Last night I dreamt that all my possessions were laid out on a lawn, including my membership of the order, there for me to choose what to take and what to throw. So it definitely felt like it was quite a strong time. It was quite a painful time. Eventually I crossed the river, and I didn't go to the high cave because the weather was so bad. But my back was getting bad, and the only cure for my back when it's bad is lots of exercise. Well, if I see a chiropractor, that helps, but there wasn't one handy. lots of exercise and meditation, that helps. That can cure my back. If I sit in a very good posture, that can cure my back. I couldn't meditate in my tent, and outside it was wet. Sometimes I could sit outside, but not for very long because of the rain. So eventually I thought, okay, I'm going to go up. I'm going to go up to the cave. I knew the weather up there would be pretty unpleasant, but I was very lucky. As I was going up to the cave, caves are hard to come by. I said that at the start. Caves are rare things to find. On the way up to the cave, I found another cave. And in some ways, this one was better. It had a flatter bottom, it was more waterproof, and it was full of jewels. It was full of quartz crystals. Out of the walls and out of the roof and out of the floor, was quartz crystals. And so that was delightful. It was big enough to lie down in, to meditate in. Making a shrine in there was almost no question because there was just crystals everywhere. I could just put my little pictures of the Buddha and of Bansi there, and they were immediately surrounded by beauty and jewels. So I stayed there for a while. I could go out and I could come back and just lie in this cave and steam and drink tea and eat. And meditate. I did quite a lot of meditation whilst I was in that cave. It felt like it was hard to believe that there hadn't been other practitioners in that cave, because there was two little grottos. One of them was it was a stream basically. So I didn't even have to go out to get water because there was drips in the cave. But there were these little grottos that were full of jewels. Yeah. It was like they were perfectly made. And here's something I wrote while I was there. Rain. Rain's hard. Fresh snow is settling 100 meters above the cave. Conditions are hard. Don't know how much of this my back will take. I went to the high cave today. Very wet. Need good weather for a week or more before moving. Another cold day in the mountains. I do nothing but meditate and eat, meditate and eat. What is this mind that so enwraps? What is this flow of experience? An impersonal flow of conditions and this seeming living experience. Mind and the world so enveloping each other. Bliss soaring like a bird, like a cloud, or an uncomfortableness, a restlessness, a volition with no object, a hunger for an unknown, ungraspable peace. I have sorrow, I have regret. I have not taken refuge in children or family approval. Not in career or money, but in the mysterious, ungraspable Buddha. Here I sit. I've made choices that have led here. Here I sit in a cleft in the mountains, in front of a makeshift shrine, at the end of a wintry summer day. The wind howls outside and stirs within. The cold chews anything with less than three layers. Memories of strong character come and sit with me, then leave. The river roars like an animal, like an avalanche, whispers like a child. I love. I wait. My heart is too open to weep. I watch. I love. I do sadhana. So much suffering in this world, so much pain and grief, foolish accidents that so harm others, the pain and sorrow one must feel. Good plans going bad, hard work to no avail, loss of lovers, friends, children. Somehow may my love, my efforts benefit others. The next few years will see so much suffering as environmental changes affect homes, livelihoods and foods. May all beings love one another. May all be kind. May all beings try to help whoever needs help. In hard times, in all times, may love prevail. So I moved up to the higher cave. And that was good timing, actually, when I finally made it up there. The next time I'd gone up after that first visit where it was very wet, the next time I went up, there was 200 icicles, maybe more, hanging from the ceiling of the cave. And I'd just gone up to visit, just to see what it was like. And it was so beautiful. It was just all these little strips of ice hanging from the ceiling. Some of them as big as an arm, most of them just like a matchstick or a cocktail stick. And I sat in there and meditated. And the sun warmed the air outside, and one by one these icicles would crash around me. So eventually I moved up there, and I remember sitting outside. As I got there, I sat outside. That's the view, as I say, from the cave. I sat outside and did Vajrasattva sadhana. I sat inside and did Vajrasattva, and in the morning I did Vajrasattva. And it's a very strange thing doing sadhana. It's a very strange thing being part of a Buddhist order. I felt so much significance about that. I think one of the wonderful things about this movement is that if you don't join the order, there's a whole world of practice. There's a whole sangha to engage with. There's no lack if you don't join the order. If you do join the order, there's an explicit saying yes. There's an explicit saying, this is where I stand. This is me. This is the life. And at that point, the order responds, or your preceptor responds, by giving you a sadhana. And there's something so powerful in that gesture, in that relationship. It's a two-way thing. I made that commitment. I made that commitment to Sura, to my preceptor, to the Bhante, to the order. And the response was, or part of the response is, that I've got these relationships with Buddhas. It's like a formal introduction to a Buddha. And I think it's very good that we don't hand those out. Yeah? They're not available unless you go through the mill. And I think that's appropriate. And I'm very, very grateful that I was put through the mill. I put myself through the mill. And I'm very grateful that, it was a very useful mill. It was what I needed to do in order to prepare me to meet the Yidam, to meet my sadhana. It was what I needed to do. Doing all that Vajrasattva, I had a... No, I'm not going to talk about that. So I'd sit in the cave. This is taken from the flat bit at the back of the cave. And when you sit in meditation, your eyes are 45 degrees or so down. So if I had my eyes closed, I'd be sitting just like anywhere. If I opened my eyes, I could see about half a mile to that lake down there.
So I'm sat here, and that's my view
straight down. And it's quite interesting, because normally, if you're meditating, you open your eyes, and there's the floor right in front of you. But I'd be opening my eyes, and it'd be half a mile away. And sometimes, once I opened my eyes, and there was a golden eagle circling below me, looking down onto the back of this eagle. And other times I'd open my eyes and there'd be chamois sort of strolling around underneath me. So it's a very simple life I was living up there. The weather improved. Previous solitaries, I'd practiced brahmacharya. I'd practiced restraint of body, speech and mind, sexually. And I'd often found it very difficult. I'd be chewing the carpet. It'd be a lot of effort to practice that stillness sexually of body, speech and mind. And I remember on a solitary 2 or 3 years ago, it was like being run over by a bus continuously, and I seemed to be making no progress. But on this solitary in the cave, brahmacharya was just so easy. I didn't really have to do anything most of the time. I was taking because I could do it, it seemed, I was taking a vow. I wouldn't have taken a vow if I didn't feel confident that I could practice it, but I was taking a vow on the moon, on the full moon and on the new moon for the next half cycle of the moon. I didn't have a watch or a date, so the sun was my watch and the moon was my calendar. So what I learned from that, it felt very clear, it felt very obvious to me. The effort that I put in previous solitaries, it hadn't seemed to bear fruit at the time, but now it was bearing fruit. It was just, there it was. I'd put in a lot of effort to no avail, but it wasn't to no avail. I was reaping the fruits at a later time. So there was things I was doing on this solitary that seemed hard, or that seemed like I wasn't making progress. But I just felt so confident that if I keep going, it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter if the fruits aren't immediate. I just felt such a faith in that process. I say I didn't have a watch or a date, so I did take a telephone. I took my mobile phone. I bought a special SIM card that nobody had the number of. So I wasn't getting phone calls from the Buddhist Centre saying, Sarah had a boiler's broken down. And I gave the number to my parents and to Sangharakshita's secretary. So I didn't want to be out of contact. I didn't want to be unavailable if someone got ill or needed me. So about every 10 days, I'd turn the phone on and see if there's any messages. And fortunately, there generally wasn't. So very simple times, lots of beauty, lots of simple pleasure, just the simple pleasure of existing in the mountains. The snow covering the mountains slowly receded and left brown earth, which turned green and then it flowered, and then insects appeared, and within a few weeks the insects had mated and they grew ragged and they had holes in their wings and their flowers died and the seed heads appeared and waved in the breeze, in the wind. And like always with these places, there were storms. Just above the cave, it's a steep hillside the cave is on, and at the top of the hillside, which is only 100 metres vertically, maybe a little more, it becomes a very loose cliff. And so there's often rockfalls. I'd often be sitting in the cave and rocks like rugby balls would go crashing, ripping past the mountain, past the cave. And it's very, life felt very fragile. 5 days of no rain. The cave roof nearly stops dripping. Thunder ground in the distance this morning. Now a second or two behind its flash, I fear rock falls. I retreat to what I think is the safest corner of this cave and watch hail painting the mountains white. As water streams from the rocks around me. Last night, I sat on a rocky mountain peak, knees overhanging a 300-metre cliff, worshipping and worshipping the green goddess of love as the full moon rose and rose and rose. This morning, I meditated on a sunny, grassy mountainside, letting myself become the breath, metta, the Skandhas and Vajrasattva, slowly with love, savouring and becoming. Even if human perfection is unattainable, impossible, I will still strive, I will still worship. Even if the Buddha never was, I will still love, I will still worship. Now huddled in a dark corner of a wet cave, I still have a heart full of love. I still love the thunder, the fear, the love, the longing. I still love this world of beings, even though I hide away. Even though I'm beyond the man-made, my heart gets closer, softer. The rain has stopped now. The drips in the cave are steadier, softer streams. An hour ago, I, unseen, watched two chamois playing, dancing almost, in snow, a heart full of love and wonder. So that fragility of life, it was quite a strong element of the retreat. I definitely had a sense that it wouldn't take much for my head, my body, to be popped like a grape. And nothing would change. Nothing would change, except that I wouldn't be there to experience it. And I felt a lot of remorse of my past actions. I felt a lot of gratitude. I felt a lot of gratitude to my parents. I felt a lot of gratitude to Bhante and our order and our Sangha. The remorse and confession was, it just felt like a natural thing. One time I wrote, "May my foolish views be swamped by the Buddha's silent clarity. May my contrary wranglings be overwhelmed by the perfect one's perfect love." But not enough just to hope and wish for purity. I did a bit of building work in the cave. The cave was just for the first few days, because it was the way the cave is, it's just this crack with these giant boulders jammed in it. At the back of the cave, there's like a channel going up to the mountainside, and in that channel, there's some huge boulders that were very, very loose. And above them, there was a lot of rock, a lot of stone, which could easily have fallen down that channel, and right underneath where it would land would be my little head. So I did a little building project of building a dry stone wall to try and make that less likely. Yeah. Less likely that it gets to me. And that, I felt quite good about that. It seemed like, you know, my dry stone walling skills aren't very good, especially when it comes to sort of trying to resist structural impacts. I should have had a health and safety engineer with me, but I didn't. So that was that. Another practicality was food. We'd taken 50 kilograms of food with us. We'd eaten about 15 kilograms of that between us, the four of us, in that first week. My main shortage was gas. We got our gas, or half of our gas, got confiscated going through the Channel Tunnel. So I had to ration my food, and I really had to ration my gas. My tea ration, I wasn't doing it formally, but I was generally averaging about 2 or 3 cups of tea a week. That's pretty much what I was drinking. My food was In the morning I'd have a good breakfast, muesli or oats with lots of very good dried fruits. I'd taken really good quality dried fruits and lots of nuts and powdered milk. And I'd have a big mug of muesli. If it was cold, I might even heat it up. I might even make it into porridge if the weather was really bad. And then for lunch, I didn't have much for lunch. That was my hardest time, in a sense. I sometimes just a few bits of chocolate or a bit of shortbread. The mice got to one of my stashes, and in 3 or 4 days, ate 2 weeks' supply of shortbread, which was a bit of a shame. And then in the evening, I'd have a good meal, and I'd have cooked rice, lentils, pasta. Had some dried tomatoes, I had dried vegetables that I'd bought specially. I could pick greens off the mountainside. and that was all good. I think I could quite happily say that for those 2 months, 2.5 months, I was hungry for almost all of the time. I felt healthy. I was sprouting things, largely thanks to Haiku's initiative. We got in the community, we got into sprouting lentils and chickpeas and wheat and rye stuff. And that was great. So I'd have these little plastic bottles that I'd keep warm inside my clothes as I meditated or as I slept, and they'd sprout. And that felt very healthy. It's a bit of an art living in this particular cave. The flat bit in the back of the cave is little bigger than a carry mat, the roof low 1 foot at one end, where I store mouse-proof tins of food, high at the other end, where I can stand and where I have 3 hooks hanging from chalk stones, which I hang stuff that doesn't mind getting wet, needs to be kept away from the mouse. Along the side of my carry mat is a row of large stones that are fairly stable, on which I put things: mala, water bottles, shrine, boots. If any of the larger objects get knocked off, they could easily roll down the cave floor to the main entrance and keep going until they reach the flatter ground, stream or lake 300 metres below. This slope is cliffy, grassy, and boulder strewn. No sun reaches the cave floor as it is pointing down too steeply. The west wall is 2 huge boulders jammed between the floor and ceiling. Repeating myself slightly there. I did knock something off the ledge once. Knocked one of my shoes off and had to go all the way down to get it back. But those sort of things, because of that steep slope, mindfulness was obviously very essential. If I dropped anything, it would quite likely never be found again. And so life was very simple. I was swimming in these lakes. As the snow receded, it would leave bits of water, and I could swim in the lakes. And the sun was hot enough just to dry in the sun. If it was cloudy, I would sometimes swim if it was cloudy. If I went a lot lower down the mountain, there was a very shallow lake in a peat bog, which was very warm. It was brown, but it was warm. It was almost body temperature almost. You couldn't stay in this particular one very long, but the one lower down was very, very warm. That day that I knocked my shoe off, as I was going down to get it, I thought I may as well keep going and go up the mountain opposite, which I did, and that was the mountain opposite, so I went up there. What pleasure to wander the hills, still as a soaring vulture. The sweet pine, the fat tadpoles, the lark. I meditate in the shade of overhanging cliffs and swim in silent lakes. so still they reflect the sun undistorted through mist, like the moon in a blue hazy sky. What pleasure to be able to love this suffering world from the inside. Mist swirls, softening the sun, yet my mind is clear. What pleasure to soar like a vulture, to love with the larks, drifting with the fragrance of the pine. So, very delightful, simple times. This was sort of in the middle of the retreat. I was doing quite a lot of meditation, a lot of mindfulness of breathing, a lot of five skanda reflection, lots of just sitting, and doing lots of sadhana. I said at the start that I was looking for a space where there was no samya, where I was softening my propensity to label and interpret everything. And one time I was meditating on the skandhas, and I reflected, I sit fairly still in a chaotic circus of khandhas. All thoughts are welcome in this cave. All fears, all memories, I greet them all with interest and with love. There is so much sorrow in this world, I can hardly bear it. Here I sit. I no longer know what I'm doing or why I'm here. This life, sorrow, love, hope, joy. A world full of sorrow, love, hope, joy. Here I sit. I know not where I'm going. The fact that I enjoy the ride no longer seems relevant. What is this life, this world? I'm here in the darkness of night, drifting on the breeze. There was a mouse that lived in the cave, and he would come. There's only one. I only ever saw one, and I'm pretty sure it's always the same mouse, which is sort of contradicts evolution, doesn't it? Contradicts everything. But there seemed to be one mouse. He's a pretty hardy mouse because he lived in this cave that was probably full of snow for about 8 months of the year. So how he survived, I don't know. So I did feel a certain compassion for this mouse, and I'd give him, clothes is what you seem to want most. And often while I was meditating, he'd come out and lick my clothes as I was sitting there. And he had at first I thought he was chewing my clothes, but he was very shy, but if I very carefully opened one eye, I could see his little tongue licking my trousers as I was meditating. I gave him a little present when I left the cave. I didn't give him too much food when I was there, but he took some. He'd always find little bits. And I never tired of watching it. I'd be meditating and he'd come out and I'd just be so happy just hearing him scampering around. And once or twice I was anxious that he might have died. I told this to Banti when I got back, and he said, yes, you can understand why people in prison befriend mice. And it's like, well, yeah, I really can. I felt such a connection with this little mouse. And if there was a thunderstorm, or one time the cave flooded, and I didn't see the mouse for a couple of days after that, and I was, thought he might have been struck by lightning or something. But eventually he came back. So I had that mouse. I was reflecting on the skandhas. I was particularly interested in samya. But one day I was meditating. I think I just finished reflecting on the skandhas and I was just sitting. And in some ways this felt like the heart of my retreat. This felt like the moment that was strongest at the time. I was sitting there meditating, I think I was just sitting, and a fly flew into the cave, and it flew around my head, and it flew out. And I was aware of Vedana,
was aware of feeling, very neutral feeling. I was aware of samya. I was aware there was an interpretation. There was, that's a sound. That sound is a fly. It's come, it's gone. Yeah, it was samya. But there was no sanskara. There was no volition. There was no wanting it to go, wanting it to be there, to not be there. And I was very struck by that. It was overwhelmingly peaceful. It was like, well, it's like nothing I'd ever experienced before. It was just an incredibly, it was a deafeningly silent moment. There was no volitional response. And that made me reassess what I was doing. I'd thought of trying to soften samya, but what I realised then was, no, it's not samya. Samya actually is an omnipresent mental event, according to the Buddhist tradition. It doesn't stop. What does stop is sanskara. What does stop is volition. In the Wheel of Life, we have vedana followed by trishna. Trishna is equivalent to sanskara. Trishna is thirst, sanskara is craving. They're used fairly interchangeably in the canon. And that's the gap. Yeah. So you have vedana, and then you have either sanskara, you keep going around the wheel, or you have shraddha, you have faith, which is the spiral. So it felt like, after all these years of practice, the first time that my mind had responded creatively, it felt like the first time that I wasn't just reactively going around the cycle. The gap between wheel and spiral is when samskara is replaced by what? By love. Is that what faith is? That open love that wants nothing for itself, but wants, yearns for a world made of love. A love that yearns so silently, the vulture soars without blinking. He flies like he's made of the air. Rainbows float silent amidst the chaos and singing waters. The evening sun leans everything inwards. I climb above the clouds and find myself on the edge of a pure white ocean, Picdumidi black against the palest, bluest turquoise. So that was an experience. That was a very strong moment of, well, of peace, I suppose, of tranquility. I find with my meditation that I don't think of myself as a good meditator. I'm not very good at one-pointedness. What I'm interested in, what I do when I'm meditating, is a broad awareness. Yeah? I'm aware of everything that's going on around me, which I suspect from the outside would just look like distraction. Yeah? From the inside, it often feels like distraction. Not always. Sometimes it's with awareness. What I'm doing in meditation is broad awareness and reflection. But after this experience, in the next few weeks, I found that as often happens after you have a strong experience like that, my mind got very scatty. Yeah? My mind just wouldn't sit still, it wouldn't focus. And so I felt I needed to do some work on one-pointedness. And, you know, I think when that happens, when I do that on solitaries, I don't often do it. Maybe once every solitary I'll spend a few days focusing on one-pointedness. And it's very fruitful. One of the things I did this time was, I do this thing where you sit in meditation and you deliberately make too much effort. And then you deliberately make not enough effort. And then you make too much. And then you make not enough. And it has a very powerful effect. You know you're doing it deliberately, so it isn't, doesn't feel dangerous. It doesn't feel like you're getting into a bad habit. But by doing the too much, the too little, it helps me to work out what the right effort is. Another thing that I would do, and this is what I'd normally do if my mind is very scatty, if my meditation's not going well, what I normally do is I just sit there until it calms down.
And this time it seemed to be taking about 8 hours. So I'd sit for about 8 hours distracted and just my mind all over the place, thinking about all sorts of nonsense. But after 8 hours it would start to calm down. Or sometimes it would just go, it would just calm down. And worth the wait, I felt. It's worth the wait. I seemed to have to do it every day. Unfortunately, it didn't carry on until the carry through the night into the next day. Only a little bit sometimes. Otherwise, I was doing the Anapanasati, which I find very effective for that. So before I'd found that the skandhas were like a circus. It was like being in the middle of a chaotic circus. And now I wrote, the khandhas like a landscape around me, somewhat more pleasing than a circus. I sit, letting them slowly roll, slowly unfold. Their stillness, their massiveness awes me. Like a dance of currents in an ocean of tranquility, their pushing and pulling amuses me. I am these mountains, these movements, and yet this space, softening lightly through love into space, holds them like a feather in a breeze, holds them like light in the air. This evening I meditated on the pinnacle ledge. Up on a cliff above the cave is a small flat stone. It can be reached by climbing down from the ridge, stepping over a chasm and climbing up. A very tricky operation, but once done, one can sit, both knees in space. Down 300 plus meters is the boulder-strewn shore of the lake. Ahead one can see France, or a blanket of cloud as tonight, with the yellow sun setting into it. To the left is the mountains of Spain. So I like to do things like that, to put myself in particularly strange situations, for no apparent reason, and sit there and see what happens. And what in that occasion, I remember, what happened was I did mindfulness of fear. I just sat there terrified. I remember the first time I closed my eyes. I sat there for like, you know, maybe 20 minutes with my eyes open. And it'd be like, if you lean forward just a few inches, it was like... And I closed my eyes and it was like, it was almost a shock. The idea of that I might lean forwards or that this rock that I'm sitting on might collapse. So yeah, it's strange. Strange thing to do, but there we go. That's what I do. Am I? That was the 8 minute warning that this thing does. So that was, I've left these photos still. This was my view for so long. Lots of just sitting, using the breath to steady and the khandhas to let go and to understand. Now the moon has gone, only the Milky Way and a million stars light the snow. A bat cheeks his way around the night. What am I? What am I doing here? Overcoming greed, hatred and delusion? Recognizing there is no self, so that I become non-attached to things, to outcomes, to people. So that I can be useful, love people as they are, and do what I can to help. I definitely felt by now that it was, I'd sort of done what I wanted to do and it was time to leave. So I left it another couple of weeks, I think, after thinking that, or a week or two, and then set off walking. And I had about 40 or 50 miles to get to a train station. I found this train station on the map and I thought, well, I'll walk there. And I took 2 weeks to do it, which is very leisurely. I think the first day I walked less than a mile, and the second day I walked about a mile and camped. And sometimes I'd pitch my tent and stay there for 3 or 4 days and just and meditate a lot, or go and, you know, climb a mountain. And that was a really delightful time. I felt that in the cave I'd learned how to meditate outside. I'd learned how to meditate in a place where you had to keep some sort of awareness. There was animals, there was potential rockfalls, there was the weather. But I'd learnt to not mind that. Yeah. If you think of the Buddha in the jungles of India, he wouldn't have a shrine room to sit in with insect netting and closed doors and keep out, please be quiet signs. He'd meditate under a tree. And often the disciples of the Buddha would talk about the mosquitoes and the creeping insects and the biting insects. And they talk about the roar of the lion in the distance and fear. So it felt very good to familiarise myself with meditating outside. I talked to Lokabandhu about that when I got back, because he's a very keen outside meditator. And I didn't really think there's something in it. I think there's something in it. Me and Matt are planning to go and meditate in the city centre, which I greatly look forward to. So I felt it was time to come home, and I wrote. No, I won't read that either. I got to the train station, and as I got to the train station, it was like, this doesn't look right. And I went to the tourist information and asked if there's any trains. And, well, I'd missed the last train by 40 years. The last train was in 1970. And the delightful tourist information girl had a wonderful smirk. She told me she wasn't sure when the next one was going to run. So that's pretty much all I've got to say. I did eventually, fortunately, the train had been cancelled, but somebody had put on a bus service, so I got on a bus. The bus driver looked like he had a terrible hangover, so driving around these hairpin bends with this driver did seem a bit dangerous, but there we go. I ended up getting back in the sleeper and going to Paris and spent 2 days walking around the rough areas of urban Paris, which I love, in the pouring rain, which I didn't love so much. And then I came back to Birmingham. And the Buddha Centre's very good at helping me to do these sort of things. I'd got 3 months unpaid leave, and I decided before I went that I wanted to come back a week or two before that ended, so I could just arrive, so I could just sort of be at home. So I got home 2 weeks before my 3 months was up, and just spent 2 weeks being around the community, which was a real delight. It's really good. And yeah, it was very interesting. The last few days have been very interesting, preparing for this and going through my diary a bit more. I think I continued that theme of not wanting to analyse, so I haven't been dwelling too much on what happened when I was in the cave or when I was in the Pyrenees. And when I started doing that more systematically in the last few days, it's quite stirred me up, because it was such a it was such a particular time for me. I feel very happy to be back, and in some ways it's been the easiest return that I've had from the solitary. But there was something about it just seemed sort of somehow perfect. And to try and recall it or be too close to it, I just sort of didn't want to do that. I wanted just to, well, I did that, let that go and engage with this. And I think that's the best way. Thank you.